Here now is the moderator of today's program, Stephen McCormick.
The world of medicine continually adds new phrases to our everyday language. The newest, happy pills, a phrase that covers the range of new tranquilizing drugs designed to ease the problems of the mental illness and strain. This year, 35 million prescriptions for tranquilizers will be filled. Now, while success has been reported in several phases of their use, warning signs were posted this week by the American Psychiatric Association. Today, here to discuss the use and effectiveness of tranquilizing drugs are Dr. Smiley Blanton, director of the American Foundation of Religion and Psychiatry, and author of the book Love or Perish; Dr. Herman Denber, director of psychiatric research at Manhattan State Hospital; and Mike Gorman, executive director of the National Mental Health Committee and author of many pieces and books, now the new book Every Other Bed. Well, gentlemen, with millions of Americans taking daily doses of these so-called tranquilizing drugs, do you feel there's any danger to people doing that? May I start with you, Doctor?
Well, I would first start out by saying that I object to the use of the word tranquilizing, since it does not really accurately reflect the use of the drug and the nature of the drug. Of course, it comes from the idea that these were drugs that had a sedative action, and therefore it rendered the patient into a tranquil state. To answer your question directly, I would say yes, there is a danger in the use of these drugs indiscriminately, without prescription, and without control by their family physician.
Mr. Gorman, how do you feel about it?
Well, I would say this. First of all, I want to join Dr. Denver in saying that the use of the word happy pills is most unfortunate. This is a silly business at best. They are pills which control severe agitation in certain cases, but happiness is an elusive proposition. And just one more thing, Steve, and that is this, that there is danger in the casual use, but I think that has been somewhat exaggerated, and we have overlooked the tremendous revolution they have caused in an attack upon mental illness.
Do you feel that there has been some value?
I think that it's been enormous, as I've only seen it touring hospitals in the last 11 years, but I have seen a leap of several centuries in the somatic treatment of mental patients through the use of these drugs.
Let me go to Dr. Blanton and ask his opinion.
Well, there are two aspects of it. One is the treatment of mental patients in mental hospitals by these drugs, and these drugs have been able to accomplish a great deal in mental hospitals. They have taken the place of electric shock in many cases, and they've enabled people to go out of the hospital in a much shorter time than before. That, of course, is well recognized. However, I think that the great danger of these drugs is for the average person who's taking them without proper supervision. It keeps them from getting adequate treatment at the time, and these drugs have side effects which are not entirely known at the present time, and which I think may very well give rise to serious problems.
You mentioned without supervision. One must have a prescription to get these drugs, must he not?
Well, yes, people get them. They get one prescription, then they'll drop the doctor, and then they'll have it refilled, and then they'll go away and maybe get 50 of them, and they'll be taking them all by themselves and not coming back to the doctor. Many people I know just take them without very much supervision.
Do you think we should confine our activity then in terms of treatment to the conventional methods?
No, by no means. These drugs will help the person overcome an agitated or unhappy, perturbed state and make them available for other kinds of treatment. You can't help a person who is so upset that you can't talk to them very well, like a person you couldn't help very much when he's in a state of rage.
Mm-hmm.
So these drugs are very helpful as an adjuvant to psychological treatment and other kinds of treatment, too.
Steve, I'd like to...
Yes, Mr. Gorman.
I appreciate the fact that some people say these drugs are merely adjuvants. I've done a study of this over the past 2 years. In 90% of the state hospital patients receiving the drugs, they receive no psychotherapy whatsoever. Why? Because there isn't the personnel in the state hospital systems to give them psychotherapy. Now, I appreciate the need for psychotherapy, and I wish to goodness there were thousands of more psychiatrists to give it. But in New York State, where you've had a 23% increase in discharges for the first time in the history of New York State, this has been due to the administration of these drugs. In St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, for the first time in 101 years, you had an absolute reduction in number of patients. And Dr. Overholzer, the superintendent there, when I asked him about how much psychotherapy was given, said, we just can't give any. We say, here's your hat, good luck to you, go to your family and come back once a month for a maintenance dosage. Now, I don't say that's good, but I want to put the matter on record.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to Dr. Denver.
I would pick up the theme in this way, that we must really divide the problem into, A, the use of the various pharmacologic compounds for psychiatric illnesses in outpatient treatment, namely in the office, by either the general practitioner, who really is the first psychiatrist the patient sees, and B, the use of these various compounds in the state of the psychiatric hospitals. Now, there's no question, if anyone reviews the literature, the results, or actually tours the hospitals, that these pharmacologic compounds have produced the most extraordinary change that has ever been seen in the past years in the psychiatric hospitals. Now, take our hospital as an example. Our director, Dr. John H. Travis, who's been there, who's been in psychiatry some 35 years and at the hospital since 1940, states without question that he's never seen any change in a hospital of this type. We were
this
able
has
to.
Been because of the drugs?
Because of the drugs. Now, insulin, coma, electrotherapy, psychosurgery have been used there hitherto. Hydrotherapy was used in the years gone by. However, as a result of the mass application, in our particular case was chlorpromazine, Rohwilfia can do approximately the same, we were able to produce an improvement in 81% of the patients treated to a point where there was one patient ill 30 years since 1926 who was subsequently discharged.
May I have asked this question, Dr. Blanton? I've read of perhaps 20 to 30 million neurotics, so-called, in the United States. That's one estimate that's been given. This is a rather scaring figure. What is a neurotic? How do you define a neurotic? What makes a person neurotic?
Well, I think there's a lot of loose talks about neurotics. To be very obvious, I can say we're all neurotic. If a person can work and play and love adequately, then I'd say he was not neurotic. He may have various traits which make it difficult for him, but many people have defenses against these things. A man may, for example, have a very bad temper which makes him blow off from time to time, but he may have defenses about it which enables him to go along. Or a person may have fears of various kinds, and he has defenses which enable him to go along and to be adequate in his adjustment to life and to succeed in his family life and in his work life. And such a person I wouldn't call neurotic. I think it's loose talk to say that everybody's got a problem is a neurotic. It depends how he handles the problem.
Well, how do they get these prescriptions then? If we're thinking in terms of tens of millions of doses of these drugs being taken this year, prescriptions are given out by doctors. I trust that the doctors feel the person is ill. But are we concerned, or are you concerned with the fact that there might be some 30 million of these pills sold this year? Is this a bad thing in your point of view?
I think it's a bad thing because I think that it just keeps the people from really trying to find out what's wrong with them. This article by Mr. Berg in Look magazine.
Oh, yes, that's the next issue of Look at the newsstands on Tuesday. That's Roland Berg's medical editor. It says some very interesting things in there. What about it?
He brings out some very interesting things. One man, example he gave, which we all know about, similar examples, was that a man was had to make a speech, and he was very nervous and upset about it, so he took some of these calming or tranquilizing pills, as you call them, and he wasn't worried at all, and he got up and made a speech. It wasn't worth a hoot. So he made a mess of things. So sometimes it's well to be a little anxious and worried and tense, otherwise you don't do a good job.
I noticed, Mr. Goldman, that Mr. Berg, in this Look magazine article called Happy Pills, says, too, that another potential danger in happy pills is the depressing effect they may produce. Have you found from your experience this is true?
I'm going to refer that to Dr. Denver, but I would like to point this out. At the American Psychiatric Convention a year ago, which Dr. Denver attended, the drugs were first introduced, and the resistance to them was tremendous. Now, you can keep bringing up arguments against them. There isn't a medicine that doesn't have side effects from aspirin on out. There are people who are allergic to aspirin. There are people who get penicillin poisoning. But in my tours of the state mental hospitals, I've usually found that the doctors have a great deal more anxiety about these pills than the patients who want them to get well and who say the trouble with these doctors is they worry about the side effects too much, and I just want to get well. Now, there have been long-term studies of these. You see, too much of this discussed, if I may say so, Dr. Blanton, without real documentation. For instance, the values of psychotherapy are just matters of faith and affirmation so far. We've had no real good evaluative study, and I fought for this for many years because the only decent studies I've seen and of any physical therapy and mental illness have been the long-term studies done on the drugs. Now, we've studied some patients for 3 years. We've mm-hmm. studied thousands of them. In New York State, 41,000 patients have been on the drugs for a period of time. And so we can come to some reasonable conclusions. Now, some of the people are allergic. To some of the people, they're toxic. But let's put it in its proper perspective. I sometimes feel a sense of reality here at this table. It seems like a little tea time discussion compared to the revolution I've seen, the removal of camisoles, of restraints, of the horrible things that I've witnessed for 11 years. I've seen an enormous change, and I can't discuss it in tea time fashion.
Mm-hmm. Dr.
Denver. I would say this much, that the emphasis, the fact that so many millions of people are going to be taking these various pharmacologic agents has more of a social implication for me. If they really need it, and I recall when I was in general practice, I calculated between 80 and 90% of my patients really had psychological problems underlying their somatic symptoms, and that was perhaps one of the driving forces that put me into psychiatry. It's not so much that 20 or 30 million prescriptions will be dispensed, as is the fact that 20 or 30 million Americans require drugs which will calm them. It's been said that this is an age in which everyone is anxious. Now, the social implication is that the anxiety is reaching an intolerable pitch. I would also like to emphasize this point, that you hear, one hears a great deal of argument in a hysterical and anxiety-ridden fashion that this drug produces such and such side effect, and that drug produces another side effect. Forgetting for the moment, as has been pointed out just a moment ago by Mr. Gorman, that the constructive results that these compounds have produced in the hospital have been unmatched and unparalleled. And as long as we focus our approach on the constructive aspect of these various pharmacologic agents, then psychiatry will move forward. Remember, the hundreds of thousands of patients are not interested in what the doctor feels about the side effect in his own personal problem. The patient wants results. These compounds can produce them. I've seen them all over Europe where they've been in use since 1950. And it's our obligation and our duty to use the drugs and to understand the side effects in terms of their theoretical implication, and that's really where the problem lies.
Dr. Blanton, does that change your opinion at all from the comments of these gentlemen?
Well, I think that we must keep clearly in mind that whether we're talking about patients in a psychiatric hospital who've had a psychiatric breakdown, and whether we're talking about the man in the street who's a little nervous because he has to make a speech, or a man who's had a battle with his wife and they're about to break up, a person who feels he doesn't like his job and therefore he's anxious, or a person who doesn't get along well with his boss. All of these are social problems that we have to face. And I think that if we think we're going to cure them by taking some drug or other, that we are overlooking the essential fact is that we have serious social stresses in our culture. For example, one of the serious facts I see it is that young people are kept in school long after some of them can get any benefit from it. And therefore, they become juvenile delinquents. Women, for example, having a difficult time in adjusting in our civilization, and especially old people. People are retiring. I see people all the time who are depressed because they've had to quit at 65 and they have nothing to do. They've made no preparation in their lives to do anything. They've made no preparation in philosophy. They have no faith. They have nothing to turn to at all, and they just look with melancholy eyes at life, and you're not going to cure them. Sometimes they come into an agitated depression. You have to do something about it. I mean, I don't mean an agitated depression sense of a psychiatric case, but I mean they're so nervous, they're sleepless and don't get along well. You may have to do something, but you really have to reorganize those people's lives. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but we've got to see that that doesn't happen to the other people who are about to retire, too.
Well, I think we're getting to the nub of the issue, Steve, which is this. I am all for that, Dr. Blanton. Except the price of that kind of reorganization and that kind of love on Park Avenue is $25 an hour. There are very few analysts or psychotherapists compared to the nature of the problem. Now, it is important to me as a former newspaper reporter to note that for years psychiatric care was practically inaccessible to 90% of the income groups in this country because it costs too much and it takes too long. Now, I am delighted that there came a mass medication which could be applied in a hospital where there were three or four physicians for 3,000 or 4,000 patients. Now, I don't say it's ideal, Dr. Blanton, that we didn't have 40 or 50 psychiatrists in that situation able to give individual psychotherapy, but we didn't and we still don't. So I hail that, which is a great advance. Now, the one further point that I want to make is about anxiety. I think every mother's son of us has anxiety. We're born into a world that we're insecure and has anxiety. And I think that if we cannot afford the detailed or prolonged analysis, which has its own side effects, incidentally, some of them quite disastrous, economically and otherwise, I think that it is good for many people in the outpatient world who have phobias and compulsions, if they can be calmed down and helped during this thing. And I've seen many studies of people who were chain smokers and who had nervous headaches who've been greatly helped by this thing. Now, I see nothing wrong with this, nothing more immoral in this than an aspirin, which we take. Paul Dudley White, in a Senate testimony this year, was asked what he really thought the best therapy was for a heart condition. He said 12 aspirins a day and relaxation.
This is with prescription you're talking about.
Yes, I'm talking about it.
Should
must be given.
Up on that?
Well, I think that I've pushed, as you know, Steve, for a strong congressional evaluation of the whole problem of what these drugs can and can't do and some tightening up on the prescription. You see, I think we're talking about two different kinds of drugs. The one that we use in the state mental hospitals, the more strong drugs, more or less the chlorpromazine and reserpin family, and then the Hollywood type of thing, which kind of nauseates me, the Milltown jokes on certain programs. This is awful, because this is indiscriminate, and it's usually given by a GP who is harassed and has 24 patients in his office because there aren't enough doctors to go around, and he throws the pills around like popcorn.
Dr. Denver, I noticed that we mentioned the word juvenile delinquent here a few minutes ago. Dr. Blanton mentioned it. One expert has said in the use of these drugs that projects involving treatment of drug addicts and juvenile delinquents, alcoholics, and others have all shown promise. Do you feel that these drugs should be used with such people as that?
Yes. I say this without reservation, and may I point this out? I wanted to get this idea in. The approach to juvenile delinquency, the approach to the narcotic addict really is a multifaceted approach, of which the drugs are just one aspect. To consider the approach to these illnesses and juvenile delinquency can be considered as such. Only from one standpoint really is doing a disservice both to the patient and to the concept. There's a tremendous moral issue involved. There's a tremendous social issue involved. We must approach these problems from many, many different angles. There's no question in my mind such patients are in need, in strong and dire need, of intensive psychotherapeutic management. At the same time...
You've got me there. Intensive
psychotherapeutic management. Well,
what does that mean?
They're in need of intensive psychotherapy, which means that they must be brought into a situation, a social milieu, where psychotherapeutic aid, or to use a better word, psychoanalytic attention can be given to them. Now, at the same time, it's been found through many studies, both in this country and abroad, that the use of the drugs has facilitated the taking of the psychotherapeutic or psychotherapy or psychological treatment by both narcotic addicts and juvenile delinquents. The drugs are no happy drugs, they're no wonder drugs. They're additional agents that have been added to the armamentarium of the psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. They must be understood in that context.
I think that's terribly important, Steve, to mention mention what I said in my book in passing, that I am tired of this business about the wonder drugs. This is not... It is a wonder that we didn't produce anything better in all the years in America.
Or
with
before.
All the before or better than what we've done, because both of the major drugs are taken from Europe. They were developed in Europe, and most of the additional drugs have come from Europe. And this is quite a commentary on a country which spends millions to produce Dacron and Nylon. DuPont spends $300 million a year in research. Now, I'm all for understanding and that kind of thing, but I'm also for basic physiological research.
Haven't we been doing that in this country?
We've been doing very little of it. We last year's level of psychiatric research was about $10 million, which is the cost of a B-52. And this seems to me a crime. For instance, there are 4 million mental defectives in this country. Now, all the love in the world cannot reach the mental defective who's genetically, metabolically incapable, practically from birth, as in the case of a mongoloid. Now, we must find out what causes 4 million mental defectives in this country. This is a social and economic crime.
Yes, Dr. Blanton, do you feel that we should spend a great deal more, say, many millions more in this research?
Spend as many millions as we can get on this.
Well, where should the millions come from?
Well, I think that these big companies that are giving money for education might give it for this. The foundations might give it. I think the government should make appropriations for this purpose. I think they have. And through what government I presume them. I presume it's through the public health service. Anyhow, money is being given, and I think we should have all. But when we've done all we can, and when we've got all the money that we can possibly get, say $1 billion, or $5 billion, or $100 billion, and let research go to the very end of the limit, we still are going to need something more than that. And there's a pathetic fallacy in humankind, which is almost an unbreakable fallacy, that there is some drug that they can take, some little chunk can be cut out of them, a little some chunk put in, and then they're going to be all right. And that is not so, because all of these things, as Dr. Denver has well said, and Mr. Gaum, is that it's to be a multiple approach. We're still going to need education. We're still going to need religion. We're still going to need schools. And one thing I disagree with you about, sir, is that you don't have to go to Park Avenue and pay $25 to get this. If you could really get the schools to put it in, every college, every high school should have courses in mental hygiene just like they have courses in physiology. And you can give it even down in the grade school.
You mean to teach the mental hygiene?
Yes, teach them how the mind is made up, what the problems that they have to face.
First, they've got to learn something, though, about do some research and find out what it's all about.
Well, we know something about it now.
Quite cursory.
Well, I don't quite agree with you.
Who knows the something about it now?
Well, maybe Dr. Denver would want to get
well,
in the middle of this cursory knowledge argument.
I have something to do with the problem. I might say this, that the amount of money that has been put into research, psychiatric research in the United States has been infinitesimal. May I point out that the advantages to be gained from placing a fraction more than has been put into it, it can be simply gleaned by looking at what's been done. One patient who stays in the state hospital, the psychiatric hospital, or Manhattan State Hospital per year, will cost the state approximately $1,000. Now, for patients who've been in there 5 years or more, the probability of their leaving are about zero. We were able to discharge, I believe, about 30 of such patients, so that for the minimal fractional investment of money the state has saved, now the taxpayers who are paying for it, mm-hmm. 30 times that 1,000. Imagine if this 30-year patient had been discharged 30 years ago, the state would have been that much richer.
I think there are many examples of that, Steve. In New York State right here, Dr. Denver, paresis, which is the end result of syphilis, the introduction of penicillin and its use has enormously reduced admissions. In the South, for instance, at one time, wards of state hospitals were filled with victims of pellagra psychosis. And for years, the speculation went on. It was due to the warm summers in the South, and it was due to every single thing, smoking of Virginia cigars. And it was finally found out it was due to a very simple vitamin, niacin. And when they discovered this and replaced this, they emptied many wards in the South. Now, that's a tremendous payoff for research. And I think it's this kind of knowledge that we can and must apply to very basic problems, of which two, I think, are in tremendous the mental deficiency, which we know nothing about, and senile dementia, which is in the same situation, and 27% of our admissions today are for senility.
May I ask this question, because I'm sure it's of interest to all of us. I know that, Dr. Denver, you have released any number of patients, a good many patients, I understand, that have been accepted as hopeless.
Yes.
And yet, through the treatment with these drugs, they have now gone back to their homes and their communities and taken up normal living again.
Yes.
Is this a temporary cure, or how do you feel about it?
This is a very interesting problem that you bring up. We have followed the problem here, and I followed it abroad. It can be considered a permanent improvement. I hesitate to use the word cure. Use the word cure if you know what's causing your illness. We don't know what causes emotional and psychotic disorders. Therefore, we cannot use the word cure. The word social remission has been used. If these patients are followed once they leave the hospital, and they're being followed now by a special clinic, and their dose of chlorpromazine is regulated week by week, and they're seen by the psychiatric social worker, by the psychologist, by the psychiatrist on a weekly basis, it's been possible, and the special clinic we have going now with Dr. Chris has shown it, that patients who under ordinary circumstances would return have been kept out. Mm-hmm. I believe without question that if we can set up units which will follow all of our patients who are placed out of the hospital, if these units of the psychiatrists and ancillary personnel will follow these patients, keep them on their maintenance dose, if the families will understand the need to stay on the maintenance dose, these patients will not return and will become useful members of the community.
Uh-huh. Dr. Blanton, getting back to neurotics again, does a person become neurotic usually early in life, in the middle span, or late in life?
Well, neurotic is a vague word. It's hard to define. What people do is dependent on several things. First, they nervous system that they inherit, and secondly, the environment that they have when they are very young, And then the problems that they have to face later on. Let me be very brief, give you an example. When I was in Wisconsin, I used to work in the state hospital there, and I saw a fellow there once. He was sitting in a chair, and he was crying, and I asked him what his trouble was, and he said he'd lost his birthright. And I asked him what his birthright was. He said, a little girl. And I asked him, how old the girl? He said, about 6 years old. And I asked him, where? And he said, he's standing right there, and he cried some more. Well, we got him well and sent him home. After about a year or so. But when you understood the man's history, you understood what his problem was. It wasn't perhaps because he had some bad chemistry, but he had a very dominating mother. And he was the right only child and lived out in the country on the farm. And he was to marry the right girl, but the right girl never came along. So he fell in love with a girl in the city, in the little village, and mother said she wasn't good enough. And they began going together, and the girl got pregnant. And then the mother said, you can't marry her. And so they had the child adopted. And then the mother died, and then the fellow married the girl. And 6 years later, they had no children, and the child was a girl. And it's easy enough to see why he thought he'd lost his birthright.
I must interrupt, gentlemen. I'd like to continue our discussion, but I find that our time is up. Thank you very much. Our guests have been today, and we thank them, Mike Gorman, Dr. Herman Denver, and Dr. Smiley Blanton. The nation's first discussion program, the American Forum, is now in its 28th year, founded and produced by Theodore Granick. This is Steve McCormick bidding you goodbye.